From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In every war, there are prisoners. In the War on Terror, there is Guantanamo. In the Iraq War, Abu Ghraib, and the hostages who live and die in the hands of insurgents. In the terrible confines of the POW's world, life often means making terrible choices between humiliation and humanity, between buckling under and fighting back, between surrender and survival. In his new book, War Trash, Chinese-American novelist Ha Jin tells the story of a little-known face of a distant American conflict, the story of Chinese prisoners in a U.S.-run POW camp in the Korean War. Two generations and half a world away, his story echoes through the historical moment we are living right now. Later in this hour, we'll look at the white-hot contest for control of the U.S. Senate. But first tonight, On Point, the novelist Ha Jin and War Trash. You can join our conversation tonight. How can humans at war, soldiers, prisoners, civilians, hold on to their humanity when ideology and power rule? How does an individual or a culture avoid being trashed by war? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me in the studio tonight is Ha Jin. In 1999, he won the National Book Award and the Penn Faulkner Award for his novel Waiting. His new book is War Trash. It's been hailed as a brilliant and original treatment of the human soul at war. Good evening and welcome, Ha Jin.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. So here we are. You chose to look at the Korean War and to see it through the eyes of a Chinese POW. And the reasons, at least for beginning, seem to tie back all over the place to your own youth, your own childhood. Your father, the book is dedicated to, a Chinese who fought in the Korean War.
Yes.
And you yourself, at age 14, sneaking underage into the People's Liberation Army, being posted to a Korean village near the border, I guess, knowing something about this. Why did you turn in the year 2004 to the Korean War and POW there?
You know, I started the book 4 years ago. So at that time, prison abuse was not in the news at all.
This isn't an answer to Guantanamo or Abu Ghraib,
no,
any of that?
No, but it was really by coincidence or accident. I didn't finish a manuscript, the manuscript for The Bridegroom. The book was on contract. The publisher was eager to publish it, but I didn't have a complete manuscript. I wanted to really to do a better job than that. So my wife suggested that I write a short, complete piece of work to replace that manuscript. So I started to write a short novel. Originally, I thought it would be like 150 pages long. Mm. But once I started, I couldn't stop. And the first draft was more than 400 pages long. So I realized this was too serious project. I had to be patient and really do the research, the homework, and do a better job. And that's why I began to work on it very patiently.
You dug deeply into the history, and the book is informed at many turns by what really did happen in Korea. Of course, U.S. forces there and fighting, and the Chinese, Communist Chinese Army, invading at a time when China itself was not really a settled political country. Right?
Yes.
That is Communist China. You describe vividly the undersupplied Chinese soldiers coming in over the Yalu River, famously, meeting the machinery of American warfare, and having their successes but defeats as well. And in the case of your main character, Yu Yuan, ending up in a POW camp, sometimes guarded over by American soldiers, sometimes by Korean, and all the conflicts within those camps themselves, as the Chinese fought over where their own loyalties lay, whether it was to the new communist regime in Beijing or whether it was to the Kuomintang, the nationalists who had retreated to Taiwan, a very complex picture.
Yes, and in fact, many of the individuals were trapped in that situation, and that's why I created a character. Really, he's not just a normal POW, because generally speaking, once a soldier is captured, he's put in jail, and he stays there. It doesn't move. But I need a character who is much needed by different faction, and he's also capable of speaking English.
Key factor. You made him English fluent.
Yes.
So that everyone needed him to communicate across the cultural lines. There.
Yes, because you see, all the fragments, all the details are there. Each soldier recalls something, but they are very fragmentary. They wrote short memoirs, like 4 or 5 pages long. Their memories are not reliable, and some of them just wouldn't want to recall. And so that's why I need a character who's, through his action, everything can be unified.
You describe this character who eventually, after a hellacious experience, comes out of these POW camps, back to China, not well received in China. As you say, the communist Chinese wanted their soldiers to die rather than be captured. And if you came home after being a POW, there was a kind of shame. But he ends up with grandchildren in the United States.
Yes.
By the end of the book, he describes himself in the U.S. visiting those grandchildren, watching The Simpsons on television, and telling us that he's written this long, detailed, often gruesome memoir as a gift to his Chinese-American grandchildren.
Yes.
Why, in your view of this elderly man looking for a gift for these grandchildren, why a memoir of wartime POW suffering? How do you see the gift that he's giving there?
And I think because he had to really organize his memory and present his experience in a coherent order. He can't just speak. I think it's too painful and also too complicated. And there's also the evolution of the tattoo on his belly. So that starts from there. And
this in the opening of the book, obscene tattoo across his lower abdomen.
Yes.
It appears to be an anti-American tattoo that he imposed on him in the prison camp. Mm-hmm. Of course, it turns out to be something more complex than that, and he ends up having it removed by laser surgery in the United States. But I'm wondering, he gives history to his grandchildren. He illuminates history for them, and that is a gift in itself.
Yes.
But there seems to be something more than that. He's trying to tell them something important about life and survival and humanity. How would you describe that, Hajin?
Of course, his own experience. I think there's a struggle between the story of his own and the collective story, the story of the POWs in the war. In the broader sense, I think throughout the narration, he struggles with that issue. And although whether he reconciled himself with that or not, but the book itself does have the resonance of the collective experience. So in that sense, it is an anti-war book. And for him, this is, I think, that is intention. And also, I think he wanted to write this for his American grandchildren because he could only write this in English. He could not do this in China. In the beginning of the book, he explained why, because he had to bring with him all the files and notes and had to do this in English, because once he returns to China, this cannot go back with him.
Because the government in China would still not tolerate this kind of very individual view of a highly political event.
In fact, even the war itself, the Korean War, is a sensitive subject. It's not allowed to be written about randomly.
Many sensitive subjects remain in China. Of all of your works, only one book, as I understand it, is translated into Chinese and circulated in China officially.
Yes, Waiting, yes.
Mm-hmm. The one that you won the National Book Award for.
At
a time when we have war in Iraq, and a lot of Americans are trying to understand exactly who is the enemy, what's on the other side of this insurgency, the other side of this war. Interesting to find you writing about the Korean War from the Chinese perspective, a perspective that I would guess few Americans have ever really considered the Korean War in depth from. You're kind of uniquely qualified to do it as a Chinese American who's been in the People's Liberation Army. But what does it leave you thinking about different views of war? We always see wars primarily from the side we're on.
Yes.
You're writing about the Korean War from, in American terms, the other side.
Yes.
What can we learn from that view?
And you see, when we talk about the war, people tend to think of victory and triumph. And we tend to think about figures, how many enemies, how characters the enemy suffered, and how many men we lost. But if we think about these people individually, each person has his own family, his lovers, parents, and siblings, then we can't continue. The truth is, every side is capable of brutality. And every side, the captors, the prisoners, everybody, war is something that really brings out the worst of humanity. That's why it's the last thing we should resort to.
The title of your book, Hajin, is War Trash. It's a provocative title. It gets your attention. It's got a vaguely offensive feeling to it.
Sure.
What do you mean by war trash?
I mean, these people, in fact, I do mean literally, they were used. They were like a litter for the battle. After they were used, wasted, they are abandoned. And at least in the case of these POWs, they were treated like that.
By whom?
By their own leaders, their own generals, their own national officials.
The Chinese leaders.
Yes. And also, you know, the capitalists really also, in a way, treated them not as kind of subhuman beings.
Capitalism or the captors?
Captors.
Captors, yes. In other words, they're American captors.
Yes. Because you know, there were too many of them. There was no way to really to treat them as individuals. Impossible. So the Americans just locked them inside a camp, let their prisoners run themselves. And so that's why all the bad things happened inside.
Because it quickly split into communist and anti-communist factions within the camps and were very brutal one to the other.
Yes.
Since you began work on this book, of course, we have seen the big lockup in Guantanamo and then the horrible pictures out of Abu Ghraib. What has that left you thinking? How do those scenes, those realities, relate to what you're communicating in this book?
I was not surprised. Really, I was not surprised because I knew there has been history in every army. You know, the abuse of the prisoners, it is a history for every army. That's why the war is really the most horrifying thing. People, just the good people, would do bad thing in it. And I think, but when I started this book, I thought the book might offend everybody, every side. So I set up a principle for myself that is to be fair, to be truthful, to be objective. And I think all the prisoner abuse in the news make the American audience more accepting to this book. And at least this is like a footnote to show that really there has been history. It's not just an American army. Every army is like this.
So when you open this door to war, you're saying whether it's the Korean War or the war in Iraq.
Or Vietnam War.
Or Vietnam. This suffering is going to happen.
Sure. And all the human beings involved, individuals, not just soldiers, the families too. See, this here, I think toward the end of the book, apparently the home also was destroyed. Home is not something the soldiers expected.
When they finally come home.
Yes.
Nothing is as they left it.
No.
And you're chalking this up to the war as well.
Yes. Yes, I think so. And because conventionally, we think we're all always in the heroic imagination, you know, like Odysseus in Odyssey, return home 10 years later and restore your household and regain your heroic status. But that was for important people, for heroes, for common men, women. That's not true.
We're talking tonight with the novelist Hajin. His new book is War Trash. Really, through that book, through Hajin's eyes, talking about humanity in the crucible of war, about, in particular, forgotten POWs in a far-off war and their echo today. You can join the conversation tonight. What is the best way to deal with the inhumane side of war? Is it to shut it away or to write a book about it? And what's the unique perspective that long-term prisoners of war in Korea or Vietnam, Chinese or American or Iraqi, bring to armed conflict? What does it take to survive the crucible of war with an intact soul? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about humanity in the crucible of war, about forgotten POWs in a far-off war and their echo. Today, my guest is award-winning novelist Ha Jin, author of the new novel War Trash. You can join the conversation tonight. How does it feel to hear the Korean War described from the other side, from the Chinese perspective? And how does an individual or a culture avoid being trashed by war? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Catherine's calling from Stoneham, Massachusetts. Hi, Catherine. You're on the air.
Hi. Yes, I just wanted to thank Ha Jin for writing the book because I think this is a really important time during which to raise the issue that every human being is a human being and needs to be treated as such, because my uncle had been a POW during World War II. He was on Wake Island and was taken by the Japanese to China and then to Japan, and it was in several prison camps. And because of that, I've been more sensitive to the issue about treatment of POWs.
Did he survive, Catherine?
He did, but he subsequently died 2 years after, when he arrived back in the States from tuberculosis, which he had contracted when he was in the prison camps.
So he survived long enough to come home to see his family, but he didn't ultimately survive that.
Right. He married my aunt and then subsequently died after she had two kids.
So when you see all the POWs that are so famously in the news in the last year or two, Catherine, when you hear Ha Jin speaking about it, what comes to mind?
Two things. The first one is that I can't believe that people will call the treatment they received under the hands of the U.S. soldiers sophomoric because they were humiliated by walking them naked.
You're talking about Abu Ghraib and the people who said yes. This is kind of fraternity-style pranks.
Right, and it wasn't fraternity-style pranks because people forget that the U.S. soldiers had the power of life and death over those prisoners. So anything that they did to those prisoners, the prisoners took as, if I resist, will they kill me? Just because they had seen how many body bags brought out already and heard rumors through the camp. So just the fact that they had been in prison and none of their relatives had ever been able to contact them meant that nobody knew they were there, and so they were quote-unquote things. They weren't people that had to be identified.
Dehumanized. Catherine, thanks for your call. Ha Jin, I wish you'd expand a bit on your thoughts around Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo. You said before it happens in every war. No one's immune to it. What was your reading of the American response to those images?
I think Catherine is right. It's not just the pranks. Really, the prisoner, from the prisoner's point of view, really for them, any of the guards can kill them at any moment. In fact, in the Korean War, there are more horrifying details. I didn't put it into the book. It's too much. But it's very true that every prisoner would assume that the guards could kill them at any moment.
Let me ask you something. You know, in the American stereotype, and certainly from the war in the Pacific and World War II and later in Vietnam, you know, there emerged this kind of stereotype of the evil Asian captor of American soldiers,
yes.
Bamboo under the fingernails, and it's exotic tortures.
Yes.
As you were born Chinese, you served in the People's Liberation Army, you've been in the States for more than 20 years now. Do you see a different attitude towards war, towards prisoners of war in the Chinese side or the Asian side, if we can take it more broadly, than from the American perspective? Or is it the same, regardless of the army, the war, the nation?
I think in principle the same, but the Chinese side, they are more subtle. You know, the word brainwash.
Mm-hmm.
So they try to really to change the prisoners' minds. By doing that, very often they try to treat some prisoners decently, materially speaking, also provide them propaganda material. But there are moments, for instance, you capture a group of prisoners, you march to a place 100 miles away. Mm. You didn't have a choice what to do with these prisoners. And sometimes they just got rid of them.
Sometimes they starve, they freeze,
sure, yeah,
they die.
Yeah, they die. And left them on the road, at the side of the road, frozen to death. That happened very, very often.
Chris is calling from Youngsville, North Carolina. Hi, Chris. You're on the air with Ha Jin.
Hi, thank you very much. I'm calling to speak of the humanity of war. There really is no humanity in any type of war. We're in a situation here, and always have been, no matter what the type of war, where government officials sit at tables in different rooms and things and decide what happens to these young kids that go over there and are so immersed by these recruiting centers that put billboards up where it's so much fun to be in the Marine Corps when you're just a bullet away from never being here again and all the fun's over. So I think it's very, very unfair to send some people into war that really have no decision on what happened when they get there or what they're doing. Or
but Chris, let me ask you, World War II, a war against fascism, the Korean War, described up and down in the United States as a war for freedom there. The war in Iraq right now, portrayed as for freedom for the Iraqis and for freedom from fear or terrorism for the Americans. Are the wars with worthy goals, wars worth fighting?
In some situations, yes, but we got to think about our course of getting there. If we're fighting unjust wars here, going back to Machiavellian times where war was unjust, we can't say anything is good about going out trying to kill somebody else that there's no further vendetta against. Now, sure, there's causes and there's causes that need to be stopped. Some things get out of control, like issues early on in the early 1900s, where some things had to be stopped.
Chris, let me pick it up right there, if I may, with Hajin. Thank you for your call. Hajin, what about this issue? You're a protagonist. Yu Yuan is bounced between people of many ideologies and perspectives
yes.
on the world,
yes.
Even between Chinese factions in the prisoner of war mm-hmm. camps, certainly the Korean and Americans. Mm-hmm. In the end, are you telling us that no ideology matters or is worth fighting for? Is that your message when you lay out all this suffering, or is it something else?
That's only part of it. I think the main part is really the idea of going home. For him, really, he, like many other POWs, were obsessed with the idea of home. They imagine home is something that is always stable. And they didn't realize the war also really deformed their home.
But I want to pin you down on this.
Sure.
Are you saying that there is no war worth fighting, Hajin, or not?
There are wars that maybe we have to fight because wars are always an extension of politics. That means really it is always we fight a war for political reason. So we have to remember this. We have to really exhaust all the other possibilities, political and the other ways.
Because the personal costs are so
yes.
unspeakably high.
Yes.
Bringing the history to life, as you have here, was really fascinating. The same islands, I don't know if it's the same islands, our caller Catherine described her uncle who'd been a POW
yes.
and of the Japanese, and these islands off Korea had been used by the Japanese
sure.
to hold American prisoners of war during World War II,
yes.
then converted into POW camps for the Chinese soldiers who poured across the
sure.
border into Korea, and many of whom were captured. But then the issue of where they would be repatriated, whether they would go back to communist China
mm-hmm.
or to nationalist Taiwan, became a huge issue.
Yes.
And I have to admit, I'd never really focused on the divergent treatment of these prisoners. Those who said they were the Chinese who put their hands up as nationalists given much better treatment than those who said they were communists in these camps.
Eventually, yes, yes. And also, I think we should keep in mind, according to the Geneva Convention, all the soldiers should be repatriated to their original country. But that was a different situation. Some POWs were reluctant to go back to China. So in principle, I think that convention, the law, was violated.
But they had terrible choices to make because
yes.
they could get better treatment if they said, I'm nationalist, but it meant
sure.
they would never be able to go back to their home if it was on the mainland.
Sure. And also there are a lot of kind of agents and propaganda personnel. They really try to sway or coerce POWs. And a lot of people, they were deceived even. But there were some POWs, they were loyal to the nationalists. They were desperate, they were eager to go to
Taiwan. That was their honest desire.
Yes.
But others, like your protagonist, sorely tempted sometimes.
Sure.
But he wanted to go home, and as you say, once he got there,
yes.
it wasn't really there.
Mm-hmm.
Alex is calling from Raleigh, North Carolina. Hi, Alex, you're on the air.
What I wanted to say was is about the nature of war itself and how it reflects the nature of man. And one of the things that I noticed you know, if you look at Abu Ghraib, if you look at actual battles themselves in World War II, or even if you look at, you know, the prisoners of war in other situations, what you seem to find, excuse me, is that the veneer of civilization or society is kind of ripped off. And you've got people acting in their most base instincts. And so once you kind of remove that the society out of somebody, you find out that man's not such a pretty being after all. And it's kind of scary. So when people are saying, you know, there is no humanity in war, you can almost flip that and say maybe there's the most basest form of humanity in war, and we fear it.
Alex, let us pick it up, and thanks for your call. Hajin, on that point then, Alex says, you know, the mask is ripped off and the truth is revealed in war, and it's ugly. Is that how you see it? Does war reveal true character? You're the novelist here. True character, or does it distort true character?
I think it brings the worst of the humanity. I think human beings, we both have the good and the evil in us. But in a social, regular social environment, all the social order, all the rules can control the bad part. But in the world, all the rules were gone. And very often people are forced to fall back on their instinct for survival. And so people become animalistic. And that's why they were ruthless, very cruel to each other.
Your protagonist, Yu Yuan, when he's in captivity, he speaks English, as you say, and the only thing he comes to have to read is a Bible.
Yes.
And he becomes very attached to the book of Ecclesiastes.
Yes.
And you have him saying, I read repeatedly, which he says, I read repeatedly and which deepened my sense of human futility. These pages calmed me down and taught me that even though I couldn't find a solution now, it didn't mean there wasn't one. I must be patient and learn to resign myself to waiting. Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask, if you are deliberately describing a spiritual journey in this novel, War Trash, and if so, what's the nature of that journey that this suffering takes your protagonist on?
You know, that journey was twisted. It could have been a much better journey than that, because religion, we know that the religious personnel are also part of the military personnel. And at one point, the priest said, I came not only with the book, also with the sword.
This is an American chaplain who disabuses Yu Yuan of any notion of religious purity there.
Yes.
He's got a political agenda
as
well. But Yu Yuan, your character, is not confined by that chaplain's view of the soul or spirit.
No. And, you know, because of the suffering and the misery, I think there is the intense religious feeling, need, spiritual dimension of life. But the communists really try to suppress that so that they can convert the soldiers' energy, concentrating on their own course and their own activities. But the religious people among the captors didn't do a very good job either. So, and as a result, I think his spiritual journey is deformed, but it is there. It's very strong. Impulse is there. That's why I think the Bible, somehow, he always try hard to get hold of a copy of the Bible.
And through all that suffering and the struggle to maintain his sanity, maintain his humanity, what is the spiritual place that he arrives at? Is it with that Bible in hand, is it a Christian sense somehow of peace or salvation, even in that suffering? Is it, as has been suggested by some of your reviewers, is it a Buddhist sense of acceptance, as he's kind of describing here, waiting, patience?
A mixture for everything, because he was not converted, and he knew that at the moment he would have to get rid of the Bible, right? Later on, he had a job. The first thing he did when he returned to the communists, he dropped the Bible.
Because the Bible would paint him as on the wrong side of the communists.
Yes, and so in other words, it really is deformed. It's a mixture for everything.
Tony's calling from Union City, New Jersey. Hi, Tony. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
One of the things that's always in my mind is that how do these wars begin? And I always seem to come up with the same thing, that the super powerful, super wealthy people of the world, these conglomerates, these people that are so wealthy, it's just incredible, and that they seem to never be satisfied with what they have. And yet the poor man is satisfied with a loaf of bread and a piece of something, a piece of protein or something like that, and
a glass. But Tony, let me ask you something quickly here. Ha Jin's protagonist was fighting for communist overlords who by definition, should not have been those super wealthy. What do you make of that?
Yes, but if there's got to be cases where people are fighting against certain things, but if you just seem to look at many of the people that are right now thinking like, you know, this president is thinking he's right, and people, why do other people say like 50% of the other people say no, he's wrong. And it seems to be that the media gets right in the middle of it and sort of likes, even they even sway people.
And in the meantime, off we go to war. Tony, we're running short of time, but we get it, and we thank you for your call. Are you passing judgment on who starts wars, why wars begin here, Ha Jin, or simply the travail of people once caught in it?
I think the latter is the truth of what I try to accomplish, that is to tell a soldier's story. I try to avoid the big sweeping narrative. But
those big narratives are the engines, as Tony says,
yes,
that drive all those thousands and millions to war.
The war was ridiculous, the Korean War. I think, you know, because it started and ended at the same place. No, either side gained anything except losing, you know, millions of lives.
We've just got a minute left. How does China, or how do the Chinese see the Korean War? They fought it shoulder to shoulder with the North Koreans against the U.S. and the South Koreans. Of course, we came up with that line of division that remains.
Yes.
How does China perceive the outcome of the war? A victory, a loss, a stalemate?
They view this as a victory, no doubt about that. They thought China was a young country at the time, 1 year old, and could confront the number one power in the world. And also they believe that this war won China a position in the world. But they ignore or they neglect the horrendous casualties, the cost of humanity. That was very often forgotten. That's why I think I want to write a book about one individual trapped in the situation.
One man's story, and it is a deep and moving one, and he comes to a kind of spiritual insight by the end that makes the journey worth all that tough experience. Ha Jin, we thank you for digging into the history, making it human, and bringing it to us.
Thank you, Tom.
Ha Jin, novelist, author of War Trash. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, a look at the hottest U.S. Senate contests. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. While all eyes will be focused on the tight presidential race and the outcome next week, a fierce battle over control of Congress will also be waged on election night. In the House, Republicans appear to have a lock on majority status, but in the closely divided U.S. Senate, 9 races are considered toss-ups. With Republicans now holding the slightest of majorities, control of the Senate could go either way. With us to discuss the contest for the Senate tonight is Chuck Todd, editor-in-chief of The Hotline, a daily news briefing put out by the National Journal. He joins us from Falls Church, Virginia. Chuck Todd, thanks for joining us tonight.
All right. Good evening.
Good to have you. And with us from Bethesda, Maryland, we're also joined by Gail Shattuck, congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Gail, wonderful to have you tonight.
Thanks, Tom. Good to be here.
Thanks for joining us. Chuck Todd, jump in with us and give us a sense of what's in play in the U.S. Senate, and not only in terms of seats, but as you look at it right now, is control really up for grabs?
Well, it doesn't, you know, yes, technically it's up for grabs in that, okay, Republicans technically only have basically a one-seat majority, 51-49.
Right.
But the Republicans have the better map to stay in the majority and possibly pick up seats. The Democratic path to the majority is just very, very tough. They have to win just about every close race. And you identified there are nine that I think that could truly switch parties. If you eliminate Illinois and Georgia, which are basically they're both party switches. That's the Barack Obama seat,
mm-hmm.
And Zell Miller's seat is going to a Republican, and that sort of offsets each other. And then you have the other nine. And I think I'll quickly just run them down: Alaska, South Carolina, Louisiana, North Carolina, Colorado, South Dakota, Florida, Kentucky, and Oklahoma. Those are the ones that if any of them went to either party, it wouldn't surprise anybody. But to see the Democrats run the table in those states, if you've noticed, I didn't mention very many presidential battleground states.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Colorado and Florida pretty much are the only two where there are some presidential races is close. Some could argue North Carolina is at least somewhat close. And that's really the problem Democrats have is they're fighting this battle for control of the Senate in red territory, in Republican states.
We're going to dip into some of these campaigns and hear tape from the campaign trail. But Gail Shattuck, first to you. You follow Capitol Hill all the time. Do the Democrats feel they've got a chance, or do the Republicans feel they're in position to cement a significantly larger majority? And, of course, in the Senate, any one, two, or three seats they gain is significant.
Well, remember that early on, Republicans were talking of possibly gaining a filibuster-proof majority. They felt that they were, as Chuck said, fighting on their own territory here. Every one of these states, with the exception of Florida, depending on how you view it,
mm-hmm.
Is Bush territory. Bush carried in the election, and therefore they felt that the winning seats was a real prospect for them. But early on, they had some great disappointments. An open seat in Colorado they hadn't expected, another one in Oklahoma. So they suddenly found themselves fighting races and having to spend money in races that they didn't think they'd have to. But now I think there is a sense that the movement at the top of the ticket may be reasserting itself. That is, there was a very interesting moment in a debate this week in Oklahoma, where the Republican candidate turned to the Democrat and said, "Why are you supporting John Kerry?" And it was a real awkward fumble because many of these Democrats are running away from the top of the ticket. And in the last few days, Republicans are trying to remind voters in these states who they're going to vote for president, and shouldn't that affect what they do for the Senate races?
Chuck Todd, if all nine should go Republican, and it sounds like you're saying that's a possibility, where would that leave the balance in the Senate?
Oh, well, I just the idea of all nine going in Republican, I would be very, very shocked. But had they do that, that would mean a net gain of, let me just calculate this real quick, 3, 4, 5. It would be a net gain of 5 seats. So it would take them from 51 to 56, and that is a substantial majority, a majority we haven't seen either party hold in over a decade. Look, I'll say this, and I'm glad you actually brought up and asked it in that way, because I will say this, very often these last 8 or 9 Senate races before an election do tend to move in one direction. They move together, and it, particularly in years when the party control changes in 2002, all the close races seemed to go Republican. In 2000, all the close races seemed to lean Democrat. In 1994, Republican. In 1986, a year that the Democrats took back control, Democrats. So it is a good way to look at it because they do tend to move in the same direction. This is would be a little odd for it to do that this year, since really the national presidential race isn't having the same effect on these races that in some years that it normally does.
I want to dig into a few of these races and get a sense of what the voters in some of these states are hearing on the ground. I've got some tape here from Sioux Falls, South Dakota. This is from a debate on October 18th between the incumbent Senator Tom Daschle, big Democrat there, and the Republican challenger, former Representative John Thune. Here they spar over who would be a more effective senator. Thune saying he'll be more effective because he'll be able to work with President Bush and the Republican leadership. Tom Daschle saying he will because he is Senate Minority Leader. The question that spurred this exchange was about trying to save Ellsworth Air Force Base there in Rapid City, South Dakota. This clip begins with John Thune.
Right now, I think the biggest concern is having an all-Democrat team led by Tom Daschle, who is the chief obstructionist to the president's agenda. I think it's going to be very difficult if that's the scenario that we're faced with when the time comes after the November election. I think we've got to have somebody that has a relationship with the President of the United States, can work constructively across party lines in the Congress to get this done if we're going to save Ellsworth.
Tom Daschle.
Colleen, you've heard me talk a lot about
how important it is for South Dakota to be at the front of the line. I don't think there is a more important example of that than Ellsworth. I was able to demonstrate how important it is to be at the front of the line as the leader of one of the two Senate leaders when I actually was in the Oval Office and asked President Clinton to take Ellsworth off the base closing list. He did. He did because I'm leader. He wouldn't have done that if I'd have been a freshman senator.
Gail Shattuck, a lot of attention to this South Dakota race because Tom Daschle is Senate Minority Leader. Lots of Republican energy and money going in behind John Thune. How's it look for each of them?
It is a very, very close race with probably more political ads per minute than any state in the union right now. I think it's very interesting that one of the first ads that Tom Daschle ran, and he's been on the air for more than a year now, showed him with President Bush in a kind of close to hug or embrace right after 2001. So he's trying to give an indication that he can work with this president and that they're close, while at the same time carrying the burden of being, as the Wall Street Journal put it, you know, the chief obstructionist in the Senate. So it's a very tough balancing act for him.
Chuck Todd, how are you reading Tom Daschle's odds of triumph or survival here?
I think it's less than 50-50, I'll be honest. I think they're really testing the limits of their turnout strategy and their ability to win on the ground there, because this is a presidential election year, and the only other time that South Dakota Democrats in the last 20 years have been able to win one of these Senate seats in a presidential election year, which is a heavier Republican turnout, you know, and more out there, was in 96, when Larry Pressler, at the time an incumbent U.S. senator, was very unpopular. Neither Thune or Daschle are very unpopular. Daschle, you know, he's got a great ground game. It's better than Thune's. But if Thune has the lead in the polls, which is my understanding that he does by a couple points, that might be enough to offset it. And I think this presidential turnout issue is just a big, big problem for Daschle.
So there's a big one. Senate Minority Leader Tom Daschle may be in trouble in South Dakota. Let's turn to Florida, where you've got former Florida Education Commissioner Betty Castor running on the Democratic ticket for the U.S. Senate, and former HUD Secretary Mel Martinez running on the Republican side. This is, of course, for the seat being vacated by Democrat Bob Graham. They debated just this Monday, October 25th, in Miami. And here, Martinez defends the war in Iraq and accuses his opponent, Betty Castor, of being soft on terrorists.
The fact is that Saddam Hussein was a cancer in the region, and a tremendous vision for opportunity of democracy in that region comes about as a result of what is building there now. What great news out of Afghanistan with a felon election. Even better news when Iraq holds an election in January. It's difficult times, tough slug, and I know our troops are doing a great job. But at the end of the day, we need a United States Senator who is resolute, who is unflinching in the face of terror, who understands that once we commit to a mission, we've got to believe in the mission. We've got to lead our troops from the front, not from the rear.
Mrs. Castor, a 30-second rebuttal.
Well, we have another agreement on this. We need a United States Senator who will be unflinching in the face of terrorism. And I resent the fact that my opponent keeps trying to build a case that I will not be. Let me tell you, we've got to keep faith with the Iraqi people. We have gone in there. Yes, it was flawed intelligence. We didn't have the information we need. We didn't secure the borders. We don't have enough troops there now. We need to double the size of the special forces. It is time that we think seriously of adding two divisions to our armed services. I'm going to be there and support our military and support these young men and women who are fighting for us and sacrificing for us today.
Republican Mel Martinez and Democrat Betty Castor fighting for the U.S. Senate seat opened by Bob Graham's departure in Florida. Chuck Todd, how does that departure seem to be sorting out?
Well, I think it's I have to give Betty Castor the slight edge. I'm actually quite surprised. I come in here, I think Mel Martinez was an impressive candidate, but the campaign itself has been very weak. They've had some internal issues. They've had some internal problems. Betty Castor had her own internal problems, but they seem to solve those. She is benefiting. She's going to benefit from what I think is going to be a higher than expected Democratic turnout. And more importantly, I'm not going to draw conclusions as to why this is, but Betty Castor is doing a little bit better in the panhandle than Democrats normally do.
The conservative panhandle.
In conservative panhandle. I've had some people suggest to me that maybe some in the conservative panel are not ready to elect a Hispanic to the U.S. Senate.
Hmm.
You know, it's no way of projecting why that is, but the bottom line is Castor is doing a little bit better than Democrats normally do in the conservative panhandle.
And Gil Shattuck, listening to that, I'm wondering how the balance of local issues versus big national security terror issues are playing, and whether Democratic candidates are picking up John Kerry's line on the war on terrorism and the Iraq war. Are they making the same critique of President Bush or Betty Castor? I mean, she may be making a critique, but she's also saying, by golly, I'm all for a big military effort in Iraq here.
Betty Castor is not running away from John Kerry, but most of the other Democrats in the toss-up states we've looked at, with the possible exception of Colorado, are running as fast as they can. So in that sense, yes, she's very concerned about shoring up her security credentials. There's a kind of subliminal in that exchange that you played, and that is a dispute over whether, as a college president, she was unaware or not sufficiently alert about a professor suspected of financing terrorism. And Martinez ran some very effective ads on that point. And just recently, her campaign came back with an ad, I think, that arguably trumped his, pointing out that she suspended this professor.
Right.
But sometime later, Martinez, as chairman of the Bush-Cheney campaign, actually invited him to campaign with President Bush. So it's also a campaign that's very quick on its feet and can pick up threatening ads like that and counter them effectively. That's why I think I'd support Chuck's prediction that she could pull this race out.
But clearly, everybody very sensitive on the issue of who's tougher on terrorism. Chuck Todd, if you had to look within these nine, then, is there a smaller handful that you would say are most in play one way or another here?
Well, I think the closest ones, the ones that we're all going to be checking the returns over and over again when it comes to the Senate, are going to be South Dakota and Florida. I think you picked out two fine ones there. I think North Carolina has closed in a hurry. I think for a long time I thought Erskine Bowles had the upper hand there. Now I'm not so sure. And he's a Democrat. The Republican is Richard Burr. Mm-hmm. And I tell you, I think Kentucky, there's something going on there. I've seen this happen before to incumbents who get, this is Jim Bunning. He was heavily favored, and then all of a sudden he had a very bad debate performance, and now the people are questioning whether he's too old for the job, whether he's completely on the ball. Democrats are being very aggressive here. The Democrats
didn't show up for one of the debates.
Well, he showed up, but he did it via satellite, and then he read off a teleprompter. And then he said he wasn't aware of certain big news stories. And
right.
Very, very tough. And I'll tell you, I've seen this happen to incumbents when all of a sudden, you know, there's nothing they can do about it. The free media takes over, and the local press is very into this race. He could get sucked into a vortex and lose, and it would have all happened within a 13-day period. It's stunning when those things happen. But they happen more often than we realize.
Well, tough and close races out there, and it's fascinating to look in on some of them. We'll be watching that count next Tuesday night. Chuck Todd at the Hotline, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
And Gil Shattuck, always great talking with you. Thanks so much for your insights, Gil.
Thank you, Tom.
On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Eileen Amata, Jane Manners, Chris O'Connor, John Roberts, James Ross, and Karen Schiffman. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook from the studios of Boston University. This is On Point.